Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After each episode, you can connect with others in the sarcoma community on our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to delve deeper into the episode's topics. You can find information on this specific subtype or your subtype, as well as all our podcast episodes on SFA's website, www.curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. Follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. Thanks for listening. On this episode, we speak with Katie Wintergerst. Katie shares her experience being diagnosed with synovial sarcoma and how she navigated consulting multiple opinions at different sarcoma centers to make an informed decision on her treatment plan. We hear her valuable insight on participating in early phase clinical trials, single parenting two young children while living with sarcoma, the advocacy work Katie participates in, her leadership in the Race to Cure Sarcoma Louisville, and ways she has felt supported in her journey. Katie, thank you so much for sitting down with us and talking about your experience. Let's dive in. Welcome back to Sarcoma Stories. I am Tasha. I'm one of your hosts.
And I am Brandy, and I am your other host.
I should also say welcome if this is your first time listening, in addition to those returning. But we have our guest today, Katie. Katie, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Katie Wintergerst, from Louisville, Kentucky. And I am a synovial sarcoma patient.
Thank you so much, Katie, for being here today. We're so excited to talk to you. And Brandy and I are quite familiar with your story, but I would love if you could tell our listeners a little bit about how your experience with sarcoma began.
Sure. So I first started feeling just some discomfort in my leg in 2015 when I was pregnant with my first son. I kind of felt a little bit of a knot, never really could get other people to feel what I was feeling. And it just felt like a muscle that had kind of cramped and not really released. So I brought it up to my doctor and they said, your body goes through a lot while you're pregnant. Let's just keep watching it, but it's probably just your muscles shifting. And so that pregnancy came and went, and I had a beautiful boy named George, and then pregnant again in 2017 with my daughter, Olivia, still on and off feeling the pain, but it never held me back from doing any type of daily life activities. And again, I was told it was pregnancy related. So I just kind of dealt with it. So I had my daughter in September of 2017, and it was starting to become more and more of an annoyance. So I brought up to my doctor, should I do some physical therapy or something to address this, because I don't want to live like this forever. They did an ultrasound and didn't find anything. And you know, fast forward a couple of months, it continues getting worse. And finally, they were able to feel the mass that I could feel when I rubbed on my leg. And they said, well, we know it's not a blood clot because you would have had a bigger problem by now, but let's go do a venous Doppler and see what that shows. And right away, while they were doing the venous Doppler, I could tell they had found something.
Did you have a discussion with your doctors at all about doing a CT or an MRI or anything outside of the ultrasound when they didn't see anything on the ultrasound?
No.
And did they not bring that up?
No, they did not bring it up either. It was my primary care doctor. It's not their specialty. When you're pregnant, it's just so much just gets swept under the rug as like pregnancy. They don't want to do things to you when you're pregnant.
Mm-hmm. But even after you had both of your kids and it was still an issue, it was more of a conversation of, we'll just see where this goes?
Yeah. They said we could do some physical therapy and I didn't act on that right away. I was like, well, let's just see. And I'll never forget, there was one night where it actually didn't ache enough to where the next morning I was like, okay, I'm going to reach out to my doctor. Like, it kept me up last night. I'm going to see what, you know, whether it's actually doing that physical therapy or what, like, I'm going to do something about it.
During this time, you're feeling pain, and you mentioned they eventually could feel the mass that you were feeling pain from. Could you feel the mass
yeah. touch during At this time?
When I rubbed my hand along my leg with some pressure, I could feel what felt like a knot in there. And I mean, it was in my adductor muscles. So deep in my leg, I'm not an anatomy expert, but I'm not like a little petite person. So, you know, there's a lot of body around it. But so you had to apply pressure to feel it. Once I knew it was there and I stood like in profile against a mirror, you could absolutely see where the back of my leg had more of a curve out, like a defined ridge than the other.
Like something is there.
Yeah.
And so once they figured out there's something there, where did you go?
So I was referred to an orthopedic oncologist here locally. They did an MRI and then they did the punch biopsies, and that confirmed that it was synovial sarcoma. And they referred me right away to an oncologist here and a radiologist. So right away, I kind of met with like three different people and I was like, what's the plan? This is a lot. Who's the point here? What the heck is going on? I had never even heard of the word sarcoma before.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, was had you ever heard of a sarcoma?
No.
Yeah.
I had never heard of sarcoma. I, as probably everybody does, goes to the internet. It was so scary. I'm like, I can't read these things. This is terrible. And I'm such a planner and a type A that I was like, okay, what's going to happen? Like ABC, and it's just chaos. I'm sure, as you all know, in the beginning, nobody can figure out. I'm sure they know, but like, it just seems so chaotic. And I'm like, okay, well, let's get going. You know, let's not waste time.
Right, especially when it's something you've never heard of. You have two young children. You've just got this frightening diagnosis. Yeah. But they tell you have a sarcoma. Do they say anything about needing a specialist? Or say anything about going to a sarcoma center?
No. So thankfully, I had people in my family that are familiar and work in the medical field. And so I just talked to family members and said, do you think I should go see somebody who's a little bit more of a specialist in sarcoma? And I remember sitting with a radiologist saying, hey, I think I'm going to go do this. And he was a really nice guy. I mean, he ended up doing my radiation here. And he said, you can go there, but they're not going to be able to give you really anything more than what we can do here. And I was like, well, this is still my life. So I'm going to take the 2-hour road trip to go scope it out and see what they say. And so I kind of went like rogue and did that on my own.
That piece that you just said, this is my life, so I'm going to go do this, I think is so important, because it is often on the patient their responsibility to take control and say, okay, to protect myself and to do what I'm comfortable with, I'm going to go do this thing. But it can be very hard. How did you know to be like, I got to take control of this and take care of myself?
With a 6-month-old and a 2-year-old, 2.5-year-old, living and seeing them for, you know, grow for as long as I could, whatever it takes. I mean, I told him, like, you can amputate my leg. If that means that I can live longer, let's just go ahead and do that. So I felt, I don't want to say judged, but I did feel a bit of, why don't you just trust us here? But I also felt like, you only get one shot at this. Like, I may be coming right back here and doing exactly what we've already talked about, but I'm going to at least go talk to somebody else about it.
Yeah, do your due diligence.
Yeah, I think the lesson here is, from a patient perspective, you have to do what's best for you. And as you said, if somebody wants to get a second opinion just to make sure they are on the right course, then that's what they should do. And if you end up right at the same place, which does happen sometimes, you still at least are at peace knowing, I have actually explored this and there's no question in my mind that I'm doing the right thing, especially in a rare cancer like sarcoma. Because what we do know is not all institutions have all the same resources. And that is a fact. And so what might be available at one institution isn't available at another institution, especially when we're talking about the community setting.
Even sarcoma centers too. Like what one sarcoma center has is not necessarily the same as what another one has.
You've been to 3 different sarcoma centers. Can you talk about being at three different sarcoma centers and how that educated you on deciding what route you wanted to go.
So when I went to the first one, they came up with what their plan was. And it was really a confirmation of what the doctors locally had already told me. So I was comfortable moving forward at that point with the original treatment plan. And they ran point out of that first sarcoma center, but I was able to do the treatment in terms of chemotherapy and radiation at home, which was really comforting to go through that, like, just terribleness of chemo for the first time and being at home. And when I got a break from being in the hospital, I got to be at home with my kids and such. I did still choose to have the tumor resected at that sarcoma center. So even though I was being treated locally, the point was really being run by the sarcoma center, and I went back there for that resection. Once it appeared in my lungs for the first time, which was just 3 months after the tumor was actually taken out, we kind of took a, okay, let's take this out approach. So we did that. And then it just kind of like popcorn kept appearing. And the doctor at that center, at the sarcoma center, I again trusted and I really liked them. But it became too much of like, well, let's just watch. And the pandemic was getting going too. And things were weird because you could telehealth, but then I'm like, this is still important. A month ago, I would have been in person. And so I said, I think I want to go to this other, even higher volume treatment center just to go see what they say and establish myself as a patient. So I masked up early in COVID, flew down there by myself just to see what their suggestion was and how it compared to the first. The doctor was treating me at the first sarcoma center. They gave me a treatment option. It was an ablation, I think, of the lung. And that had never been brought up. But I was like, okay, well, this is interesting information. Like, let me go home and consult with my local doctors, my thoracic doctor at home, and then the one at the first sarcoma center. Ultimately, I made the decision not to do that treatment plan. But I felt comfortable that I had gone and seeked out the advice, and I was then established as a patient there if I ever wanted to go back.
Yeah, it goes to your point of taking into control your plan of action and as the patient doing your due diligence to survey all your options and then make an informed decision about how you want to move forward with your care. It is your decision ultimately how you want to move forward.
And even I'll say from the provider, the way the first doctor in my hometown kind of gave me opinion on going to the sarcoma center, I still felt that from this one sarcoma center going to the other, being reminded, like, make sure it's going to benefit you as a patient as much as it's not just going to be for the science.
Yeah.
So your first treatments before, you know, you noticed it in your lungs was standard chemotherapy and radiation.
Correct.
Were you between the first, because I know there's a third sarcoma center that comes into play here too. Mm-hmm. But between the first sarcoma center and the one you went to for sort of like that option seeking, mm-hmm. were any clinical trials offered to you? Were you on clinical trials, or what decision did you make at that point?
They had screened me for one clinical trial and I was not a match for it. And so that was really kind of that.
Okay. And so at what point did you end up going to the third center and how did you end up there?
Yeah. So I kind of played around with at the advice of my oncologist at home and at the first sarcoma center, different treatment plans. I'd be on one until it kind of proved to not be effective and we'd pivot to another. A trial did come up in my, hometown and I did that for a bit. It just was kind of getting to the point where I was like, I feel like I was reading and seeing a lot going on in the sarcoma world and feeling like I really need another level of support, another opinion. And so, Brandy, we talked about it and you were able to say, I think there's this doctor here that I think you would benefit from at least going to see. And so I was able to get an appointment there and started under the care there. And that's where I've been, let's see, since like 2022, I think.
And I know that you have been on clinical trials, and I'd like to talk a little bit about your experience with that, because I know that there are people out there who, A, maybe have not been offered a clinical trial and should probably ask to see if, you know, that could be an option for them earlier, sooner rather than later, but also have been offered clinical trials, but may have some concerns about what that looks like. And so can you talk about your experience, pros and cons of the trials? Because also you travel quite a distance to be able for treatment. It's like, what, 4 hours, 4.5 hours? Which isn't easy to do as in a single parent home with young kids, and also working full time, which we'll get into that later.
Sure. So I think that the first thing that I had to become comfortable with is that a clinical trial wasn't going to be the last resort. I think that's the stereotype that's out there around clinical trials. And I had to become comfortable that that was not the reality, that I had tried the standard of care and it worked when it worked, but I needed something different. The second is I don't live in a city with a sarcoma center. And so clinical trials don't happen where I live. So if I was going to participate in something, I had to travel. Thankfully, I mean, 4 hours is a long trip. It's an overnight every time, because I can't go there, see a doctor, and come drive home, you know, 8 hours of road time plus a doctor all in the same day. So it's a commitment, and it's a sacrifice that my family makes with me. And so I've had points in time where I've had to travel 2 days out of every week to meet the needs and the requirements of a clinical trial. But I've seen it work for me, even though I'm not on a clinical trial right now. I've seen it work for me, and it's where I know the best treatment options are going to be for me for as long as I can. Go ahead. I realize that's not necessarily for everybody, too. I can do this 8-hour round trip, but if it were flying to another side of the country, like, that might not be realistic for me. And as much as I want to say, like, my family would drop everything and we would make it work, like, we may. But that's a different scenario. You know, thankfully, I haven't been put in that situation yet.
That's a good point, though, because it is a reality for a lot of people. And I mean, that's something we talk about in the advocacy side of things, is making treatments more accessible for people and access to centers. So I'm glad you mentioned that. And you also mentioned, it's a sacrifice that you make, but also a sacrifice your entire family makes. And we talk often about how sarcoma is a family diagnosis. And that goes for the emotional side of someone in your family being diagnosed, but also a logistical side, especially given that you're parenting two young children in a single parent household.
When you were deciding about clinical trials, one was a phase two. In sarcoma, I always say clinical trials become treatment. We have very few FDA-approved treatments. Most subtypes do not have an FDA-approved treatment. So clinical trials become treatment options. But as you said earlier, oftentimes people wait until it's the last resort. And trials aren't always likely to work when they're last resorts. So at least having the conversation from the beginning, are there potential trials? And then sometimes you're excluded from a trial based on the treatments that you've already had. So having the conversation about trials early on in the diagnosis process and in the treatment planning process is so critically important. But a lot of them are early phase trials, which can be a little scary. Can you talk about your thought process and ultimately how you made that decision to go into that trial?
You're right. So What I was faced with was a phase 1-2 trial. I think I was probably in the first, 15, 20 patients to be on this thing. And it required a lot of me. It was scary because I didn't know if it was going to work. I didn't I mean, you don't know if any trial is going to work, but especially with having nobody out there, I didn't know what it was going to work. Didn't really know what the side effects were going to be. I didn't know if like the what it was going to require of me, it was something that I could do, you know, that my family could do. It was just the unknown is really hard. But at the same time, what I was doing was also not a long-term plan either. And so it kind of became, well, let's give this a try. I mean, worst case scenario, in 3 months, I come off of it and I can go back and do what I've been doing. That is, we know what it's doing.
No, that's a good point. It is scary. And it is a difficult decision to make and to determine, which, as you said earlier in this discussion, it seemed like chaos. There's so much information coming at you, so many decisions to make. You don't know which is the right one to make. But as you've done, gathering all of your information so that you can make an informed decision. And I think that's so important that we promote at SFA is the informed decision-making and also the shared decision-making. So you're informed and able to make informed decisions about what path you want to go on. I also want to talk about the travel aspect, because as you said, you travel 4 hours each way. You're lucky enough to be able to do that. But as you said, where you live in Louisville, there is no sarcoma center. And that makes it very difficult because at SFA, we do promote that patients go to a sarcoma center. We do know that outcomes are better if you can make it to a sarcoma center. That doesn't mean that it's bad care within the community. It just means that we do know that outcomes are better at a sarcoma center. How did you learn about a sarcoma center? I know you made it to one that was just a couple hours away and you made it early on, but how did you find out that sarcoma center actually existed? Like when you went to say, okay, I need to see a specialist, as you mentioned, where did you go to get information as to where that specialist would be?
The internet. I mean, as simple as the internet, and didn't realize there was differences between sarcoma centers, and it was the closest one to me. And where do I see a doctor that is a specialist in sarcoma? Not even my type of sarcoma, just in general.
Yeah. Did you even understand the scope of how many subtypes there were of sarcoma?
Not at all.
Because you're a very informed patient. And I think it's, you get this medical literacy being thrown into the world. And now you probably know more than you ever cared to. Do you feel like you just were thrown in and immersed into the chaos and gained that knowledge?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I didn't have any of this knowledge in the beginning. And it was really just like, what can I do to survive and what felt right to survive or give myself the best shot of it? And thankfully, I like with advice from friends that are in the medical field, that is the field that they work in, I was able to kind of navigate my way. But
yeah,
maybe perhaps a patient would have to be more dependent on social workers or like cancer care centers, like at their local options to kind of guide them in that direction.
Yeah. It's something I think about when we have these conversations on this podcast, because I think you can learn a lot from other people's experiences. This is part of why we share this information. Someone listens to this and says, oh, I'm in that position and I can learn from Katie's experience as social workers and navigators at these centers and the care teams can give you so much information. But sometimes it's more digestible when you're hearing someone's lived experience and saying, oh, I'm in a similar position. That might work for me too.
That's why my involvement with things that I do with SFA and the Race to Cure Sarcoma series, local like events that I do, just willingness and comfort in sharing my story and my experiences are important to me. Mm-hmm. I would say that first year when I was in my initial treatment from diagnosis through tumor resection, I didn't post it on social media. I kept it very guarded. I just was doing what I could for myself at that point. But it got to a point where I was like, I'm lucky that I'm still here and I'm lucky that I can share my story. And I needed people that gave me inspiration and I wish I had had more. And now I feel like I need to do that for and want to do that for others.
Mm. Yeah, I totally understand that. And I remember actually when we first met Katie at the Stand Up to Sarcoma Gala through SFA in, was it 2023? Yes, it was 2023. And I was only, I was not even a year out of my treatment at that point. And I remember you talking about the clinical trials you had been on. You were speaking at the gala. And I remember listening to you thinking, oh my gosh, there's hope. I every day imminently wasn't sure what the next day was going to hold. And then hearing you talk about your experience, I was like, okay, there's hope. There's hope here. So there is so much value in that sharing of your experience that I think really moves people along in their journey.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to note here that Katie was our 2023 Courage Award honoree at our gala. For all of her work in advocacy and doing exactly what she just said, right, and sharing her story and working so hard to raise awareness outside of the race, but also the race, which we'll get into later. All of the work that you do and your willingness all the time to do whatever it takes to help advance research, to help advance awareness, to help advance fundraising, whatever it takes, or to be someone that's an inspiration to someone else to say, hey, there is hope. I'm still here. There is hope. So that is why we honored you. That's why we continue to honor you for all the work that you do. One of the things I wanted to touch on is you said the first year that you were in treatment, you were very guarded. I'm interested to know why. What drove that?
Initially, I think it was just a matter of survival and of just like I needed to stay focused on what I was doing and I couldn't have a lot of other distraction. I also think like embarrassment isn't the right word, but wanting to feel like normal, like everybody else. I couldn't explain to anybody why this is happening, or like I could hardly even explain what was happening to, like why I was in this situation. Like it was just purely bad luck. Like what I just needed to, I wanted part of my life to still feel normal, even though there was so much chaos going on.
That's really honest. Knowing that you work full-time as well, how did your diagnosis and treatment intersect with work? And how did you balance that?
Yeah. So I had only been working at my place of employment about a year and a half before I was diagnosed. So, and thank the Lord, it's a very people first culture. And so I have been very supported the entire time, and I still work for the same employer. I have had the flexibility, I've changed jobs, like within the company, I've changed jobs, I've changed managers, but regardless, I've been very supportive to do what I needed to do to take care of myself. When I was spending, 5 days in the hospital getting chemo, I still wanted to work because I wanted to feel normal. So I would work for the first day or two when I felt decent, and then I would not work for 3 days because I just felt too terrible. But I had the flexibility and the support from my employer to, if that's how you want to handle this, like, don't feel like you have to take medical leave. But if you don't want to, then we're going to support you doing it. And I feel really blessed that I work for a place that is that way, and probably feel confident in saying that that is not necessarily the norm.
Mm. And it's actually goes really in tandem with your comment about wanting normalcy. I think work provides that for a lot of people. And like you said, it's not necessarily the norm always for people to continue working through their treatment, but some people do have to do that, mm-hmm, to keep their insurance for treatment and to keep moving through treatment. Sometimes you do have to work.
I was going to say, I since diagnosis have gotten divorced. So since diagnosis, I turned into a single income household, single parent. That if I have to carry the insurance for me, I don't have the ability to have somebody else covering that for me.
And at any point in this journey of deciding, okay, I have to keep working, did you have any resources that you turned to help you with that?
No, I wish I had, but no. And maybe I didn't seek them out because I knew I wanted to work. And so it wasn't a topic for me what I have encouraged other friends who have not just had sarcoma diagnosis, but breast cancer, I have friends that are going through all sorts of cancer treatments, is when they say, I'm going to take medical leave, I'm like, good for you. Like, in some ways, maybe I wish I had done that, but I don't regret what I did too.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, it's everybody's journey is different. One of the things that sounds like for you that was a priority is to feel normal. Mm-hmm. And also, I wonder how that factored in with your young children at the time. And how, as Natasha said earlier, sarcoma diagnosis is really a family diagnosis, but very young children. And how have you brought them into the process with you as you've gone through this journey?
Mm-hmm. So that's been a learning curve too. At first, like tempering it to what they can understand at their age. So how we discussed it in the beginning was very different than now. But regardless, I've always used the word cancer around them. And the things I've said is like, you didn't give this to me. No one gave this to me. This is not something that you can catch from me, but it is cancer. It's not a sickness. It is a sickness, but it's not a sickness in how they think of sickness. In the beginning, there was a musical therapy guy that would visit me in the hospital, and we would do little projects where I would be able to record myself reading a book to them or whatnot that made me feel more comfortable. I hope, like, and I still think about today, like, I hope I never have to write letters to them for their graduations or their weddings or what. Like, I want to be here for all those things, so I don't think about it. But that's like that musical therapist, and that's what those people are there for, to help patients like navigate through some of those thoughts when they have kids and families involved.
Yeah, that's a very real statement that it would be difficult to believe that anyone in this position has never thought of. Your daughter is 7, and you were basically diagnosed when she was an infant. So in talking about normalcy too, do you feel like this in your family's life is kind of just the norm, like living through with a sarcoma diagnosis in your life? Like, this is the reality of what they've known since
early. Of all that they've known. I mean, she was born in September 2017, and I was diagnosed in February 2018. So it is all that he was 2, like he was too little too. It's all that they know. I burst out the first time I lost my hair. I stressed, like, I'm embarrassed now how much it stressed me out. And now, like, I have hair now, but like, I've been no hair, short hair, curly hair, all the hair. And then, like, now I'm like, why was that such a big deal? But like, me and how I wanted to, you know, feel like their mom and like every other mom, you know? It was...
You know, I have to say, when my mom went through it, my mom was... I always saw her as this really strong individual, never worried about appearance or anything like that. And so when she lost her hair and she really wanted a wig, I'm like, you're beautiful. You can rock it without it. But it was very important for her to have the wigs and things. So we went wig shopping and did all that. And I never really understood it, because I'm like, it's just your hair, right? Then when my dad went through it and he lost all of his hair, and that was a big thing for him, and I had that same conversation with him, he said to me, I just want to look in the mirror and see myself. Every time I look in the mirror, I'm reminded of what I'm going through. I know people that listen to me talk on this podcast sometimes about my journey always hear about my aha moments. Mm-hmm. I've had so many, and I continue to learn. But it was such an eye-opening experience for me, someone who hasn't gone through that journey, to hear that and really understand it. So to hear you say, looking back, why was it such a big deal? It's that sense of normalcy, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Two other things. One is that the challenges never stop, though, because at 7 and 9, especially my 9-year-old, he's very in tune with emotions, and he is to the point where I know he worries about me. When I say I'm going to the doctor, what are you going for? Like, even if I'm just going to the dentist, why are you going to the doctor? You know, they want to know, and they worry about. And now I'm like, well, how do I make them feel supported and not just by me, that, you know, everything is still okay? You know, I'm taking the medicine, it's doing what it's supposed to do, you know, like I'm doing everything that I'm supposed to do. I think that them having to live this experience has made them great people too, because when they see another person without hair or somebody who might not be feeling that great or what, they are in tune to that and are open-minded, where kids are kids. They see somebody who looks different and they might think, where's your leg or where's your hair? It doesn't faze my kids the way that it probably does other kids because of the way they've been forced to grow up.
Yeah. Right. This has been established from literally day one of this is your normal. And it provides this level of perspective and empathy as they move throughout the world because this is their life too and just how they live. Yeah.
And Kay, I know that with your experience, there's a lot of advocacy work that you have done. And one of the things I know that you did on behalf of SFA actually is went on Capitol Hill and advocated with a group of organizations and represented sarcoma. Can you talk about that experience? Because as you know, SFA has our Hill Day coming up in July that we launched last year, and we're really excited about it this year. But can you talk about that experience for others who may be interested in doing it and haven't, or, you know, maybe have some fears about it, but, you know, understanding the importance of having our voice heard?
For sure. So I'm just now thinking, I think I did that in 2019. So before COVID. It was probably one of the very first things I did with SFA besides participate in the walk here. And looking back, I'm like, that was an amazing experience. And I want to do it again, even though I haven't done it since. My mom and I went up to DC together, and it was not lobbying just for sarcoma advocacy and funding, which I know is what you all do now and why partially I want to become even more involved. It was just all cancers. But I mean, I was one of very few people there that were there because of sarcoma. And so my mom and I met with the offices for the representatives from the state of Kentucky, as well as the senators. And it was really cool to be able to feel like I was sharing my story beyond just my local area and like sharing my experience and at least making somebody else listen and realize like there's crap out there in the world. And like what you meaning like the of government officials are doing is affecting all of us. And like, I need you to realize that, yeah, it's important that funding continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did that feel like for you going into it? And then once you did it, how did you feel after?
It was intimidating because I had never done anything like it before. So going up there, we got a day of kind of like training, and that was fine. But until I went and sat in that first office across from either the actual representative or somebody from his or her office, like, and in some cases it was the actual people. Like, I met with Mitch McConnell, which was like, whoa, you know, I would never think I would actually do that, but. Once I sat down and realized that all I had to do was like share the truth and share what my story is, the facts are the facts, and I can rely on my piece of paper that's going to tell me like, you all have funded this much and this is how much we need and the gap still exists and, you know, all that stuff. But the powerful part is in my story. And once I like realize that's all I have to sit here and share my story, like, yeah, I can do that. But it was definitely intimidating at first.
That's such a great point, though, because I think, Brandy, I've heard you say this, and I know we tell our advocates this, but there's no wrong way to share your story. It's your story. So there's a lot of power, you said, in just sitting down and saying, this is my story, and this is how it's impacted me, and this is what I'm asking you. There's no wrong way to do that.
No, and that's what they want to hear. And that's why making our voices heard is so important, because if we are going to affect change, then we have to make our voices heard. And a message that we had last year on the Hill is, while you're here making decisions for all the bigger cancers, which they need everything they can get to, there are people in rare situations that you have to think about even further, because some of the systems that we have in place are not necessarily optimal for those who are in these rare situations. And so the stories become even more powerful because of the nuances of a sarcoma diagnosis. You cannot just go anywhere and be seen by anyone. We do not have FDA-approved therapies. We do not get as much research funding. We are not going to get FDA-approved therapies if we don't get more research funding and if we don't change some of the regulatory processes that we have to be able to move those therapies to the market. That is the reality of having a rare diagnosis. And if our voices are not on the hill for them to hear, then they're not going to know what our challenges are. They're not going to know that we're out here, and they're not going to know how to fix it. Part of sharing the story and being on the hill is to help them understand how they can fix it. That's what they want to hear from real people who it's affecting, and how can I make this better for you?
Right. Yeah. And there can never be enough. Like, you know, there's power in numbers. Every story shared is even more powerful. So as a rare disease, it's even more important for people to come out and share their stories.
And last year we found that oftentimes, you know this, Katie, from being there, sometimes you only have 15, 20 minutes, right? Sometimes the meetings are very short, very focused. You say what you have to say. What we found last year is they were keeping us in their office 30, 45 minutes. Meetings were lasting a really long time. And one of the feedback that we were getting is we don't often hear from groups like yours. They very much appreciated hearing our voice. And so how important it was for you to take that leap, even though you may have been intimidated at first, to go up there and just say, here's my story and this is what I need. And I'm representing, because as you said, there weren't that many sarcoma people represented there. You're representing the whole sarcoma voice.
Talked a little bit about your involvement in advocacy, but you're also very involved in our Race to Cure Sarcoma Louisville community. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about how you became involved in this and what you do?
Yeah. So when I was diagnosed, I literally also Googled sarcoma races because I was like, well, I've never heard of this. Wonder if there's a race where people get together. And like, then I found Sarcoma Foundation of America and I messaged and I was like, hey, I look at see all of these races. You don't have one where I live. Like, you know, I'd love to talk about it at some point. And they were actually working with a group of people at that time to set up the first race in Louisville. And so I volunteered that first year, but I was definitely not one of like the major planners. But my amazing family and friends created a team and they all stood behind me and we had a really successful overall Louisville race in 2019. And I had a big team and I just loved like having all these people there with me to like celebrate that I've like made it this far and like bring awareness and funds for this thing that now is going to like be a part of my life for the rest of my life. And it just became my purpose, I guess, like sarcoma. So after, you know, the pandemic hit and things kind of shifted and over time, I've taken a bigger role. And so now I'm one of the two main people that plan our event here in Louisville. And we love priding ourselves on that we have the largest event for a city who doesn't have a sarcoma center and want to just keep growing and growing the thing. We talk about raising money, but equally as important, I talk about the community that it builds and the connections that we make, like honoring the people that have lost their battles to sarcoma, giving inspiration to people that are still like fighting in the trenches of it, or just, you know, any other person who's like, I've never heard of this. Like, let's learn about what sarcoma is.
It's funny you mentioned that. Well, Louisville, for the listeners, Louisville is my home race. That's where my family lives. I'm from Kentucky. And it's a very unique race. But a couple of weeks ago, one of our guests, Maria, is just launching the Austin race. And it's interesting that most of our races do start with somebody emailing and saying, you don't have a race here. Like, let's bring one here, which is what Maria did. And Maria said for their first year in Austin, she threw down the gauntlet and she said, I heard Louisville is the biggest race. So it's not just the biggest race without a sarcoma center. It's the biggest race. And I heard Louisville is the biggest race and we're going to beat them. My goal is to beat Louisville. And so just letting you know.
I love it.
We have some work to do in Louisville because Austin is coming for us.
Well, and like I've got my eyes on Cleveland too, because we might have more participants, but they raise so much money. And I'm like, how do we get there?
Right. It's right. The friendliest of competitions. I love it.
It is. And you know, Cleveland, the Cleveland Clinic is very involved in the race in Cleveland. I mean, that's definitely a partnership. They put a lot of time and effort and commitment. They have a real commitment to their patients and they put a lot of effort into it as well. So it's a wonderful, we're very lucky to have that partnership with the Cleveland Clinic for Cleveland. But you're right, for a city with no sarcoma center, I do use Louisville as an example quite often, even when I'm talking to industry partners, of the fact that the community in Louisville for sarcoma, unfortunately, is very big. Because that means there are people being impacted by sarcoma, but it is a very, you and Connie and bringing the community together have done a wonderful job there in Louisville. And it is a really great race. It is from all the elements to it. It's a wonderful experience to be at. And I even know how important it is for my family to be there and the energy that they get from it.
One of my favorite things from last year's race was I had won largest team in Louisville every year and somebody else won it last year. And my friends were like, are you sad? Like we could have gotten more. And I'm like, heck no. Like I am excited that another team is at this point where like there's so much excitement and camaraderie behind this.
Yeah, that is a really awesome feeling. And I love the way you described the race. I'm not even going to try and paraphrase it because you hit every major point of what the races are about. It's a fundraiser, but also it's community. It's celebrating how far you come. It's honoring the people we've lost along the way. There's so many elements to it that it is just such a great event for so many different reasons. And the only event of its kind in the sarcoma community. Like you Googling, where is there a walk in sarcoma? Like this is the event. Yeah. This is exactly how I found SFA too, is from my hospital bed saying, I wonder if there's a walk for sarcoma. And this is it. This is the event.
And Natasha actually helped us start the Boston race. She was there our very first year in Boston.
Yep.
And that one's actually grown pretty good too in a very short period of time.
I know. I've bit my tongue, but we're coming for you in Boston too. I have my award sitting right up on my desk for, I know, it's funny you say that about the largest team because this will be Boston's third year. And I hope this year someone knocks me out of my largest team and top fundraising team place.
When you talk to people who, because I also know that you're very connected with the sarcoma community in general, even outside of the race, when you talk to other people that are dealing with a diagnosis like yours, what are some of the things that they communicate to you that are important to them? Like most things they need, or resources that they would want when they're diagnosed?
How do I know the right steps to take, I think is the main one. And you all created that question guide. And that is an awesome tool, I think, that even now, like if I were to have to go meet with a new doctor and talk about things again, like I would still leverage that. You know, it's you don't know in the beginning like what to ask. And so I think that's, people are looking for advice in the beginning on what did you do and why did you go there? And, you know, like, why didn't you just take what they said here for face value and just go with that?
One of the things you mentioned, too, is a support group for single parents dealing with a sarcoma diagnosis. Can you talk a little bit about that in your mind, like how that could be helpful to you and others out there who are in the same situation as you?
I think any sarcoma group, it doesn't have to just be for single parents, is valuable. So We have a Gildas Club where in Louisville, and there is a sarcoma group there. And I was not part of planning that. And there's been times where I've been much more active in it than others. But in the beginning, it was another place where I could kind of find people that were like inspiration to me, that they've been down this journey. And this is a dedicated space where I can ask questions and get advice.
That's great. And I actually wonder, Katie, you've been doing this for 7 years. What would you say to someone who's just entering the sarcoma world who needs that push or that inspiration? What would you tell them as somebody who has so much experience?
Mm-hmm. I would say it doesn't have to define you. You know, you, me, we've been struck by this like curse of sarcoma. And I try to remember, I'm going to give it the respect that it needs and it has to have because I want to live. So I'm going to give it all the attention that it needs, but I'm not going to give it more. And I'm still going to live my life. And so I'm going to go on vacation and I'm going to keep working and I'm going to do all the things with my kids and plan for the future because I'm going to be here. But I'm also not going to ignore the sarcoma because that's not going to let me be there.
At the beginning of this, when you introduced yourself, as a sarcoma patient.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, I know even at SFA, we call survivors, even people in active treatment. But I'm interested to know what that means for you and why you said, I'm a sarcoma patient.
That's a good question. I struggle with that one. I actually was listening to one of your all's podcasts earlier and the guy introduced himself as a patient. And I just never feel like, to me, when you are a survivor, and this is probably wrong, but I view it as like, you're past it. You've crossed the finish line and like it's not part of your everyday life anymore. And even if somebody has sarcoma and has been in remission for 20 years, like sarcoma is still part of them. But I would view that person as a survivor versus me. Like I'm still take medicine every single day to keep the spots at my lungs at bay and hope that, you know, that works for a really long time. And so that distinguishment between patient and survivor is really tough for me.
Yeah. That's so valid, Katie. And I can't think of one person who I've talked to who's been given a sarcoma diagnosis who hasn't echoed that in some way of finding like that thin line of like patient to survivor. And the technical definition of survivor is from the time you're diagnosed to the time you die. So even when you're on treatment, you're a survivor. But that you said that word has a connotation of like, I've crossed a finish line, and that's very difficult. I don't think you're alone in struggling with that at all. And you had just explained that really eloquently.
We've talked about this on this podcast of the journey's never really over, right? Even if, you know, you have technically survived it and you're no longer on active treatment, the journey, it's a part of you. And as you said, it'll be part of me for the rest of my life. It doesn't just end. Something else that comes up is support systems. And how have you found your support system? And how were you able to accept support? We hear a lot of people talk about how in the beginning it was difficult. And I know you and I have talked about that. That it was difficult for you to even ask for support in the beginning. And how have you had support in your journey? And what advice would you give to other people who are looking to support someone who is going through this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was something I had to learn, was to say okay and accept the support, because people wouldn't be offering if they didn't want to give you the support anyways. And sometimes that support looked like meals dropped off at my house. Sometimes the support just meant like, hey, how are you doing? I've been thinking about you. How was your appointment last week? Sometimes the support is, let me pick your kids up for you and go do this. you could probably use a break, or I know you have a whole lot going on. So the support isn't the same for one journey the entire time, or from person to person. The other thing I would say is, to me, I would personally rather have a smaller, tight-knit support group than like feeling like I'm getting actual physical support from a huge group of people. I just have kept my circle, while I'm very vocal with my experience, who supports me the most, I've kept that like pretty tight. And that, I think, is just personal preference. But you couldn't do any of it without support. And thinking a child going through sarcoma, it's not just for the child. It's for the parent has to have support. And my mom is one of my biggest supporters, and she needs people to support her too.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's so many players and everyone needs support. Mm-hmm. You kind of have to figure out what works for each person, and each person finds the support.
Mm-hmm.
What's a message you just want to leave with listeners today? Mm-hmm.
To just live every day to the fullest. I have sarcoma, and so that's kind of my main driver of, I don't know how long I'm going to get to live with sarcoma. So I'm going to take advantage of every experience and everything that brings joy to my life. But somebody else might not have sarcoma, and they might not know that, you know, their time on earth might be coming to an end. So it's just, so nobody knows when their last days here are, and just enjoy life and just surround yourself with people that bring you joy.
It's incredible perspective and a really good message. And then my final question is always, if somebody wants to connect with you, if a listener wants to connect with you, they're a part of our community, you're a part of our community, where can they find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So Facebook and Instagram under Katie Wintergerst. And then if you connect with SFA, you know, they can share my personal contact information with people too.
That's so generous. And we'll make sure to link your Instagram handle and your Facebook in the show notes, in addition to the Facebook group where you can go and talk with others about the podcast. We have a Facebook group dedicated to the podcast. So lots of places to connect. Katie, thank you so much for being here today. It is always great to talk to you, and we just appreciate you so much and all you do for the sarcoma community.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners, to amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients. SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important, as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link.